Welcome to Sentence to Paragraph, a podcast on the space between wordcraft and the writer's life. My name is James Stiegel, and I'm joined by my co-host, Daryl Lynn Evans. Today we're joined by multi-genre author and teacher, Eric Witchy. Eric Witchy has sold more than 100 short stories in many genres to publications like Clark's World, Writers of the Future, Writer's Digest, and many others. He has published 4 novels. His most recent novel is called Bull's Labyrinth. He also recently published a collection of short stories called Professor Witchy's Miracle Mood Cure. Eric has been a working writer and teacher of writing for more than 25 years. He was born in Ohio and currently lives in Oregon. Eric, thanks for being on the podcast.
It's nice to be here. Thank you.
Well, your new novel, Bull's Labyrinth, has just come out. Would you like to talk to us a little bit about that? Tell us what it's about.
Oh, sure. You know, it's I'm not sure what genre to put it in, because I don't think in terms of genres, but I think that it's probably a fantasy romance suspense novel. no, I'm serious. That's that's what it is. So it's the story of the mythology surrounding Daedalus in Greek myth, and how he falls in love on the ancient island of Crete, and how that love develops into a curse that affects the two lovers for thousands of years. So there are actually 2 stories. There's the story of Daedalus falling in love and the corruption of the political system of ancient Crete and how he and his lover Nikki survive that or don't survive it, as the case might be. And then there's the modern story of how Nikki, as an archaeolinguist in the modern world, goes to Crete and fights the corruption of government and the corruption of artifact smugglers in order to break that curse. So that they can finally be together after 3,000 years. So it's a switchback plot novel. There's the ancient story and the modern story unfolding simultaneously and informing one another so that the reader has a sense of urgency and momentum. It was a lot of fun to write. It was a lot more fun to research. I had to go to Crete and hang out in Greece for a while and walk the Minoan ruins and go to the museums. So that was a lot of fun. So it's out. Right now, it's still, at this moment, while we're filming, while we're doing this podcast, it's still in ARC format, which means that it's available online for 99 cents for about 24 hours. And then the new version with the corrections will appear and the price will go up. The paper book will be out at the end of July, should be out in time for the Willamette Writers Conference. And at that point, readers will be able to order it from any bookstore. I don't know what bookstores will carry it. But I know you'll be able to order it.
Very exciting. I know that it kept me up all night, so you owe me a night of sleep. And it really an amazing read. It was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it immensely.
Well, thank you.
I was fascinated by how you wove these 2 different timelines together. I mean, that just seemed like a really huge challenge in and of itself, the historical Daedalus story and then the modern Nikki story. But it's just so masterfully done, and to have the 2 distinct narrative voices for those, and yet they do weave together as a whole. How did you achieve that?
Yeah, that was hard.
I bet.
How did I achieve that? That's one of, that's a question that has a very long answer. And, I think we only have an hour, and that's not enough time to explain it. The thumbnail version of it is I recognized that there were 2 stories in the story I was telling. There was the story of how the curse was created, and there was the story of how the curse was broken. And then I did a lot of experiments with different ways of presenting those 2 stories. Whose story was the curse? Whose story was the breaking of the curse? And in the end, I decided that the old story, the mythic story, was more familiar to people and required a mythic character, which was, of course, Daedalus, who in mythology created the labyrinth that the Minotaur lived in. He created the cow that Queen Pasiphae got inside in order to be inseminated to create the Minotaur. He created the wings that killed Icarus. So because he was such a substantial character from the past, I gave him the past story. So I also had to find a way of balancing the 2. So in the past, it's Daedalus' story, but it's balanced with an antagonist that is female. And in the foreground story, or the modern story, I gave the story to Nikki, and then I balanced her with an antagonist that was male. So in terms of the real estate of the story, the dominant real estate in the ancient story goes to Daedalus, and secondary real estate goes to the female antagonist. And in the modern story, dominant real estate goes to Nikki, and secondary real estate went to the male antagonist. And that was in part informed by the fact that in ancient Crete at that time, there was a matriarchal and patriarchal religion, and they were about equal at that time period in terms of power. And I was attempting to explore the conflict between those two sort of gender-oriented religions, the religion of the bull and the religion of the serpent. The serpent being the female fertility goddess, and the feminine influence of creativity, family, community, and tribe versus the dominance mode of the bull and the herding cultures that were coming into the Minoan culture at the time. And you know, those are all background things that are going on. They're not the story, but they inform the decisions that went into creating the switchback narrative that I created. Now, on the dramatic level, on the actual story level, you get into issues like where does this scene belong in the chronology? Does this scene cause the reader to understand the scene in the other story? So if I write a scene in the ancient story, then does that scene cause the reader, when they're in the modern story, to have an increased sense of urgency? And if so, then those two scenes need to be, you know, physically close to one another in the text. So there was a lot of whiteboard work, a lot of matrix work, you know, working with Excel spreadsheets, putting stuff up on the whiteboard, which, you know, the listener can't see, but we can see each other in this interview, so you can see the whiteboard behind me. I filled it and erased it and filled it and erased it and went back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, did experiments in terms of how to organize the story across time and relative to the two timelines. At one point, I had the two stories completely written as separate stories, and I had to basically throw that away and then restructure them. Once I understood them well enough, I could throw them away and restructure them so that they informed one another back and forth as they moved forward. And then you add to that their pacing issues, which revolve around the nature of conflict in scene and the pacing of dialogue, and then the lengths of scenes, and you know, is this scene too long and causes the reader to lose the sense of urgency in the other story you're telling? I mean, it was a bitch. It was hard.
Did you find yourself enjoying one story more than another, or it sounds like you worked with both of them enough that they were equal, or did that become an issue?
There was a period of time where it was very much an issue. I was much more interested in the Daedalus story than the Nikki story at first. Later it flipped. I got sick of Daedalus, and I sort of started loving Nikki. And I don't mean that in an authorly sense. I was kind of OCD infatuated with the idea of Nikki. So, you know, that was kind of
weird. She's quite beautiful.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Nikki is actually based on a woman that I met in Crete. I mean, physically, she's based on a woman I met in Crete who was truly just stunningly gorgeous. You know, like, stupid, I can't talk to you, gorgeous. And so I used her as a model. And then there was a period of time where I was sick of both of them, long period of time where I was pretty sick of both of them. So, yeah, you know, that goes back and forth.
How long have you been working on this story?
I finished the novel in, I think, 2007 and started marketing it. But I couldn't get any market traction with it in the large press, in major publishing. So I had to go to a small press. And I only did that after the primaries in the small press badgered me for years, literally for years. I was getting responses from agents, editors, et cetera, like, you know, there's too much romance and there's not enough historical fiction, or there's too much historical fiction and there's not enough romance. Well, you can't have a historical novel like this and violate the mythology because people know the myths. You know, the endless stream of ridiculous responses has been fascinating. You know, one person says, this is a brilliant book, but we can't use it because we're not doing books with magic. And the next one was, this is a brilliant book, but we can't use it because it's too much historical fiction. So you know, in the end, it sort of fell into a trunk. And then Elizabeth Engstrom started badgering me about it a few years ago and really kind of bullied me into finally cleaning it up and getting it out there, for which I'm very thankful. The reader response has been brilliant. The reader responses have been really gratifying. I did not expect to have the kind of reader response I've been getting. I expected it to be just another book, but people are reading it and saying things like Daryl Lynn said, you know, my God, I was up all night and you son of a bitch. And I got in trouble with my niece's husband wrote me and he said, you know, that I got him in trouble because he was reading the book and he didn't hear his wife talking to him. So she got mad at him, and that's my fault, of course. That's as high a compliment as you can get as a writer.
Well, we will send Liz a chocolate bar as a thank you for making you put that out. So it was done in 2007. How long, yeah. Like, what was the actual, I mean, prior to that, how long did it take you to compose it? And I presume there was some rewrites after when you brought it back out of the trunk,
yeah,
or whatever.
Actually, there were four stages. The completion in 2007 was kind of the first completion. After I got some feedback, then I rewrote it again in 2010. So I guess there were three big pushes. And then this cycle that brought it out was the third push. I don't think in terms of calendar, I think in terms of hours, because it's the nature of the beast that these things evolve over time in terms of calendar. So you go through months where you're not working on it, and then that's all you're working on for a month. And then, you know, then I have to do a corporate gig, a corporate document, and that's all I'm working on for 6 months, and then I come back and I picked this up again. So the total hours on it are right in the neighborhood of 1,500 hours.
Wow.
For that book. Yeah, that's not, well, I mean, there are books that take longer, there are books that happen faster. I mean, the How I Met My Alien Bitch Lover is a completely different kind of book. And, you know, it's very tongue-in-cheek, and it's you know, partly comedic and partly suspense thriller. And, you know, that only took 700 hours, so, you know, half the time. And it was very fast because it was contiguous time. That book happened all at once, and this book's been broken up over the years, so it's hard to measure.
Mm. Wow. I think we want to talk to you about the language and metaphor and whatnot in there, but I think that it would be really great to hear you read a little bit from Bull's Labyrinth, and then we can talk a little bit more about the beautiful language and amazing work that you do.
You're setting him up there.
I see. Okay,
it's so good.
Well, if you want to talk about the brilliant language, then you need to tell me where it is. Because I'm sorry, but when I read it, I see flaws. I've been in it so long, and I see it as... you know, I see the errors things I want to improve. So are we talking about like the middle of the book, the beginning of the book? Because I can start reading at the beginning. I'll read to you. I'm happy to read to you.
Well, why don't we start with the excerpt that you're going to read, the opening piece.
Do you want to do it now, or did you want to do it later?
Yeah, no, it's good. Let's go and do that now.
Okay. Can you still see me?
Yeah.
Just fine.
Okay. Okay. This is the opening of Bull's Labyrinth, and chapter one: History Repeats. Only a hedge and a chain-link fence stood between Nikki and freedom, between her and love. Evening shadows had hours ago grown into warm summer darkness. Her luck and the dark of the moon were synonyms. 17 was too old to never have been kissed, and if she let her parents have their way, she'd be in her thousands before love was hers. Night creatures filled the air with songs celebrating love. Crickets, frogs, and cats urged her on. Her parents' home loomed behind her, a colonial red brick and pillared monster, stabbing twin chimney horns into the night sky and trying to intimidate her suburban neighborhood's split-level ranches and salt boxes with its patriotic shadow. Her parents claimed to be American, claimed they had left the old ways behind, claimed they had never spoken a word of Greek to her in her entire life, and they denied that her fluency in Greek had anything to do with them or with anyone from the old country. Even though they claimed all those things were true, they watched her day and night. They treated her like some dusty third-world herder from the stony hills of Crete might steal her virginity at a Safeway or at the Liberty Mall. Not tonight. Tonight she chose. She chose a new life, her own future. Not even the old ways of family handed down through history could stop that. Nothing short of dark magic could keep her from love. She dashed across the dewy black lawn, or the dewy back lawn. A silent meteor streak cut the star-speckled sky, a teaser for the light show Dade had promised, the Perseid meteor shower. At the hedge, she knelt, cold dew soaked into the knees of her jeans. She reached through the tangle of scratchy branches, groping for the chain link beyond. Over her shoulder, she watched the dark house for light or signs of life. For a cold moment, she wondered if she'd reached through the bushes at the right spot, at the fence post where missing clasps gave the fence the most give. Finally, she grasped the cold, galvanized steel wire. She pushed hard against the bottom of her father's fence. It lifted up, and she shouldered the bushes aside and peered through a low, leafy archway into the dark alley beyond. Holding up the fencing with one hand, she slid under feet first. A little wriggling and some cold wetness on her back got her through the shrubs and under the fence. She sat up and checked the alley. Between back fences and garbage cans loomed the dark form of a station wagon. His station wagon. Dade's broad, solid male silhouette filled the space behind the steering wheel. She stood and tried to brush herself off and shake the twigs and leaves from her long, dark hair before he saw her. A part of her had believed he wouldn't be there. She was pretty and she knew it. Boys, men, and even women lit up when she walked into her room. Their silly grins or shy smiles or wide-eyed stares made her dismiss them as fools. Not Dade. He was never foolish. Always clear-eyed, intelligent, and intense. He'd always been respectful. So respectful that she'd been afraid he'd decide not to show. She was sure he loved her, as sure as she was that she loved him. She trotted to the car he'd rebuilt himself, an ancient golden Ford LTD wagon named Helios, a glorious chariot made of steel and restored by his clever hands. Like the legends from her homeland, he was a clever god among the boys of her school. Dade was a hero worthy of her love. He leaned across the seat and opened the door. Another streak of light slashed through the heavens. It illuminated his face. Smooth cheeks, a decisive chin, eyes the color of dark olives, rich and flavorful and filled with promises of nourishment for her heart and soul. He smiled. Dark, curly hair glistened. She held her breath. For a moment, she forgot her fear of discovery. The melodies and harmonies of crickets, owls, and tiny frogs stopped. The night held its breath with her. As quickly as the meteor flash had come, it faded and left only darkness. She slipped into the car and settled against him on the vinyl bench seat. "I didn't think you'd come," he said. His voice soothed away any fear she had that they would be caught. It convinced her that she had truly escaped her parents' home, that she and Dade were together in the night, for the night. She wanted to answer, but her breath was still short. She was here, and it was enough. He nodded and let off the brake. On the alley's slight slope, the car rolled forward. To Nikki, the quiet crunching of loose gravel under tires sounded like summer thunder. Beyond the fence and hedge, a light came on. Her father's sharp voice cut the night air. "And Nikki!" "Go," she whispered. "Go now." Dade turned the key. The headlights flared. The Ford's engine growled to life. "Go," she said out loud. She amazed herself that she would do this, that this man could convince her so easily to sneak out, to violate the trust of parents who had always done their best for her. Except Dade hadn't convinced her. She'd convinced herself. She wanted to be alone with him more than she had ever wanted anything else in her life. Her father stepped out into the alley. His white t-shirt, bald pate, and heart-patterned boxers glowed in the headlights. "Nikki Ariadne Aristos!" Dade let off the gas. His finger twitched on the wheel, reaching for answers. She'd seen it before. He reached for solutions with his hands, as if he could feel them and draw them from the air. But this was no time for searching. "No," Nikki said. "Go." She stomped her foot down on his, smashing the accelerator. As his mind and heart joined with hers to move the muscle and bone of his arms and legs, he smashed down with her and hit the horn at the same moment. Fire burned under Helios's hood. 400 horses leapt forward toward the darkness, carrying Dade and Nikki with them. Her father leapt from the path of the car. She pulled her foot back, turned in her seat, and looked out the back window. Her father stood up. He waved his hands in the air, his face red in the taillights. He screamed at her. It was the first time she had ever heard him speak Greek. She knew the curse words, but she'd never used them. She would pay. Tomorrow. She turned back and settled into the seat. "He's okay," Dade said. Really pissed, she said. I'll be grounded forever. Worth it? She grinned. We'll see. His hand found hers, and for half an hour they drove in silence, knowing one another's thoughts through the movement of fingertips on the back of a wrist, through the slipping of one finger from between two, from the occasional squeeze or caress. When they stopped on a dirt track in the hills east of Portland, Oregon, nothing in the world existed for her except this boy, this man who so completely left her empty of thought and filled with fire and hope. He'll still be mad when we get home, Dade said. Are you sure? The meteor, she said. I'll tell them I had to watch them for a school project. Uh-huh, sure. And if he sends the police to find us? I'll protect you, she joked. I'll tell them I kidnapped you. A white ball of fire lit the heavens, turned the sky briefly blue-white before it faded back to daylight. Blue, then darkest blue-black, and finally to a black that slowly filled with stars. Wow, he said. She looked at him. He wasn't looking at the sky. Her hands sweated in his, her face burned. The time was right. Now, she thought. Do it now. Kiss her. Give her that, at least, if not more. And nobody else could do it, and no matter how angry her father would be, or how long she would be grounded, or how she might be punished, or how much her mother cried, it would be worth it. Like he heard her thinking, he leaned toward her. Just like the heroine in a romance novel, her blood made the sound of surf in her ears, and her pounding heart threatened to break free from her chest. She could smell the spice scent of his soap, the thin smell of machine oil, and the certain power of chemistry in his sweat. She also thrilled to the flinty stone scent, a thrilling, powerful smell that seemed to surround him and nobody else. She tilted her head to make it easier, stretching to bring him to her sooner. He hesitated, asking her permission, as if her being there in the car against her parents' wishes weren't enough permission. He turned his head slightly and pushed past her lips to her cheek. His lips grazed her face, slipped in under the long looping curls over her ear. So close. Her nose touched his warm nape. His hair smelled of stone dust and oil from sculpting and working on the car. Deeper down, closer to the skin, he smelled of love for her. She smiled and pressed her lips to his neck. I've always loved you, Nikki, he whispered. I always will. She knew men said such things to get what they wanted, but she also knew he meant it. She could feel the promise in his hands, the power in his words. He meant it deeply and more completely than anyone had ever meant it through all of time. He kissed her ear. She shivered. She reached to wrap herself around him to become a part of him. He pulled back and touched his lips to hers. Her heart fed on his soft touch. The night sky lit up as bright as day. The inside of the car glowed, and she knew the kiss lit her world, and only the kiss, because she closed her eyes. Not even the Perseid meteors could fill the world with so much light and fire, and she wanted it to last forever, but it didn't. The kiss ended. He pulled back. Abruptly, Dade opened his door and got out. The chill of the night air rushed in and closed around her. Dade? She asked. He screamed at the sky. At first, she smiled, taking the scream for a howl of joy and triumph. She understood his happiness and slid across the seat to join him. She would howl at the sky beside him. He screamed again. The scream carried fear and rage. It went on and on, longer and louder than she had ever heard anyone or anything scream. Agony and terror tore from his throat and spread out into the night. A new shooting star lit him, showing him tearing at his shirt with one hand and his hair with the other. Falling starlight flashed in the wide whites of his eyes. His eyes, the dark, rich olives, the food of the gods, had become small, black, hard, and crazy. You're scaring me, she said. Get back in. He screamed again. The sound tore her soul. Dade! He turned toward her. Spit flecked the corners of his lips that only moments before had brought her so much pleasure. He said something to her, something fast. It sounded like a dialect of Greek, but it couldn't have been. As far as she knew, he didn't know that language. Spanish, yes. German, some. No Greek. His shirt tore. He gasped for air like a drowning man. He screamed again. She scrambled out. Through welling tears under the intermittent flashes of the sky, she tried to grab him, hug him, and heal whatever terror had filled him and pulled him so far away from her. No, she whispered. Ohi, Daedalus. No, she said in Greek. Ne, Nikki. Yes, he said. He pushed her away. Again, he said. Oh, God, not again. And he ran away into the darkness.
Wow. So good. Yeah,
well,
listen to that whole thing. Are you narrating the book for
I'm
audio?
Sorry?
Are you going to read it for audio? We could listen all day.
No, probably not. I'm not that good. I don't know. I don't know how that's going to work. I know that it's going to happen, but I don't know how it's going to work. But I don't think I'll be narrating it.
So listening to that again after having read through it, and it's been a couple weeks since I finished it, but to hear how masterfully you have very carefully and or subtly threaded in so many of the themes and so many of the images that are going to recur or that are going to become so big, that it's just wonderful. How conscious of you are you of that, and is that something you go back and do? Do you set that up from the beginning and just keep going? How does that work for you?
That's interesting. I think of every story as a puzzle. No two stories end up using all of the same techniques. So, for instance, in this story, there was a period where I understood the dramatics, the thematics, the emotional arcs of the characters, and I went back to the beginning and rewrote every scene to exploit that knowledge. Was it there the first time? No. Now, I knew he was going to go nuts, and I knew that there was going to be the screaming and craziness and, the love. But no, the things you're talking about that aren't really apparent to a reader reading it the first time. They're there because they're setting the subconscious landscape that the reader's going to inhabit. That exploitation happened fairly late in the process. I had to know a lot about this. I had to know the whole story. The story had to be done in order to do that. So, yeah, I went back and very carefully restructured that scene so that I touched on those things. And they serve two purposes. The first purpose is they are defining Nikki as a character, but at the same time, they're setting the landscape so that later on when the reader encounters, it's hard to describe without talking about it, is that when the reader encounters things that rely on that imagery or rely on that symbolism or rely on that thematic landscape, it has already been part of the reader's experience, and they are willing to accept what they experience later in the book without me having to explain it to them. And yeah, that's hard. That takes time and energy and effort and consciousness and patience. Mostly it takes patience. You have to kind of assume that you don't know what you're doing, and that's okay, in order to get to the point where you know what you're doing.
Is it ever a challenge just to free yourself up to do that first draft, or do you find is it difficult?
No, that's the easiest thing for me. Uh-huh. I can put words on page forever. Turning them into finished story that I like, that I think is worthy of a readership, that's hard. And often, I get it right, and often I get it wrong, because you don't get to decide how the reader will respond. But no, composition is the easiest thing for me. I compose it around 2,000, between 2,000 and 2,500 words an hour, and I can do that pretty much endlessly. But, that's crap.
Well, if the reader decides what is and isn't crap, I guess.
It's like the thing you were just saying. If I can compose at that rate, but that's not even close to finished prose.
Yeah.
I have to finish the story, and then I have to understand things about the story in order to get that first scene to function the mm-hmm. way it needs to. So that first pass is just about finding the story and figuring out what I need to know in order to make it a story.
So do you work off an outline typically, or are you discovery writing as you work through?
I do both. I have written stories from scratch and sold them without ever outlining. Mm-hmm. This particular story was outline intensive. There were many outlines, and there are many different kinds of outlines. In order to make all of the pieces function together, and in order to get the jigsaw to fit together right, there were many outlines. So there were periods where, I spent hundreds of hours in outlines trying to get things to work. On the other hand, those outlines saved me a huge amount of time. I couldn't have written this story just on trial and error. I had to write it and then outline it and then write it again and then outline it a different way and then write it again. And then I went through four or five outlines because I understood it well enough to begin to see where the problems were going to be. And then I had to write it again. So you know, but the good news is because I can compose that fast when I'm writing again, it's not particularly difficult. I'm able to do that because I have, you know, I know where I'm going to go, I know what I'm going to do, so I just pound it out and then clean it up.
So when conceiving of an idea like this, can you talk about, does genre even come into your thought, or do you start with character,
no,
story, and then where it falls is how it falls?
It falls the way it falls. You know, if I were in contract and I were, you know, pounding out the next novel in a series, that'd be a different animal. But I'm not. My contracts tend to be with corporate America in a different sort of type of writing. So a book like this, this was a labor of love. And it began with the, it actually began in the museum in Heraklion in Crete when I was looking at the face, those discs. And I was quite fascinated by the history of the disc and the fact that the language was not yet interpreted. And I felt like it was a prayer, a love poem. And it has turned out since then that that is what it is. I didn't know that. No one knew that at the time. When I first encountered the disc, no one understood what it was. But it was this spiral on both sides of the disc. And looking at the imagery and thinking symbolically, I had this sense that, oh, you know, this is a hymn. You know, it's a song of love. And, you know, there's a male side and a female side because that was in my mind at the time. And the story really grew from that moment. I started thinking in terms of the mythology of the island, and you know, I walked through the Minoan ruins and thought about the nature of the ruins and the historical realities of the labyrinth and the pole and the Minotaur. And I could see how those myths began at that time, because the palace at Knossos was probably the largest building in the world at the time. It's possible that there was something more elaborate on the island of Thera, but the island of Thera blew up and nobody knows what was there. So Knossos was this amazing place. And if you were, you know, if you were a herder from, you know, the hills in mainland Greece, and they brought you to this building and walked you inside, you would be lost. You know, you being used to a one or two room building, walking into this multi-story labyrinthine monster of a building would have been insane. So you know, that was the labyrinth, and at the center of it there's this arena where they took people and basically let the bulls kill them. You know, there were athletes who could dance with the bulls, but the tributes in the mythology, the tributes from Athens, of course, were always killed by the bull. So you know, this is where it began. When I stumbled on the idea of working with Nikki and Daedalus, it really began to take form. I had Nikki in mind, but I did not have Daedalus in mind until fairly late, you know, in the process of conceiving the idea. And once I had them both, then the story began to take shape. I began to look at what could I do with this story, what could I do with these characters, what kind of thematics could I explore with these two people. Mm-hmm. And that's when the story really took form. And I wrote a lot of, you know, a lot of stupid scenes in order to discover where I was going to go with it. I knew I was going to do it, I just didn't know what I was going to do. So I wrote some amazingly stupid scenes. You know, I wrote scenes where the labyrinth was magic, and you know, I wrote scenes where, you know, Nikki fell in love with another man and was trying to make a marriage work and had three kids. You know, I wrote all kinds of things, just trying it on to see how it felt.
I'm going to steal one of Daryl Lynn's questions. How does Bull's Labyrinth play into your obsessions as an author, recurring themes for you or recurring ideas that you are working through?
My obsession as an author is with how the little black squiggles trigger a dreamlike imaginative experience in the reader. That's bloody magic. And so what I obsess on, and I mean that clinically, is how that functions, how the manipulation of the little black squiggles causes the dream. So I pay attention to articles in cognitive science and reading, and you know, the changes in neurotransmitters and the way that they function when people are going into story space, the transitions in brainwave patterns when they go in and out of story space, what kinds of things take them there, the history of the production of story and its function in culture. These things fascinate me. And so every story for me is an exploration of that. The stories that I like the most tend to be the stories where I think I understand something and how it works, and so I try to do it to see if I can make it work. So in that sense, Bull's Labyrinth was an exploration of that. I was working with this, in terms of my development as a writer, I really wanted to work with this idea that I have this switchback plot going on in two completely separate story spaces. And I wanted to see if I could make them function together, because on a theoretical level, I could understand linguistically that that should work. You should be able to do that. And I've seen examples of stories where I thought that it did work, but that's not the same as being able to do it. Mm-hmm. So that's my obsession. In terms of thematics, that's sort of like genre to me. The thematics appear while I'm working with the story. There is a very distinct moment at which I come to understand a number of specific themes. So I know that each character has a thematic statement that I'm working with. At some point, I either discover or design that statement. The same thing is true for the overall book. The book itself has a fundamental premise, thematic premise that I'm working with. Each story in the book then has one. Each character in the book has one. And so I'm very consciously working with those thematics. But some of the stuff that, like, academics would call a theme, all this, this story has a theme of the underlying misogyny of the Greek mythology. You know, that kind of thing is stuff that comes up later, and I look at it and I go, oh, you know, if I change this scene, I could add that theme, or I could exploit it, or I could at least make it apparent enough that people can argue about whether it's there or not.
So there aren't specifics that are important to you. It's going to vary by story and
Absolutely. Okay. I mean, there are themes that I return to a lot. I return to themes of perception and mental health. So I'm fascinated by the physiological fact that we create our reality, that what we perceive is unique to us as an individual, and that no two people perceive the same thing. Even confronted with the same stimulus, they don't perceive it the same way. So I often find myself returning to that idea that the more we become conscious of the fact that we perceive differently, the more likely we are to be able to explore one another's realities in an effective way, in a useful way. It's only when we're sure about our perceptions that we get into trouble. When I'm sure I'm right and you're wrong, yeah, well, we're screwed. But if I'm sure we're both right, then we can do something. Mm-hmm. You know? Yes, I'm right. Well, so are you. I don't know why you're right, because I can't know that. But if we talk about the fact that you're right and I'm right, then we can get somewhere. Mm-hmm. I find that absolutely fascinating, and I come back to it quite often in stories. The Tao of Flynn is an exploration of a quasi-mythic character giving people what they want. Mm-hmm. So, you know, be careful what you want. What is it that you, how do you perceive the world? Because this guy will give it to you. So, that was fun. I have a story called To Build a Boat, Listen to Trees, mm-hmm. in which there is no magic, but there is a character who thinks that other characters are wizards, and he hates them. He hates the fact that they're using magic, and they aren't. They're just paying attention. So, you know, there's these two perceptions that are going on, that are, and the fact that one person is sure and the other person doubts is creating the conflict. You know, in Nicky and Daedalus, certainly there is a male perspective and a female perspective. There's an exploration of the difference in the religious backgrounds of the characters. There's an exploration of differences in how people perceive themselves in their culture and how they perceive the histories of their family and their culture. So, you know, the bad guy in Bull's Labyrinth, in the modern story, the bad guy is convinced that he's doing something noble for his family. And, you know, from his perspective, he is. You know, from the perspective of Nicky and Daedalus, not so much. So, you know, there's that exploration going on. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say it's dominant in that story, but I return to it. I return to issues of mental health because what we call mental health is really just a spectrum of perception. And, you know, the culture within which we live creates the sickness. My sister was paranoid schizophrenic. She's dead now, but she had a very difficult life, but in another culture and another time, she would have been a priestess, because she had a direct connection to God, and there was no doubt in her mind that she did. So, you know, that fascinates me. I think those things come up a lot. The death of literacy, I return to that quite often. Mm-hmm. I'm heart sick when I see people come into my classrooms and they've never read a novel. Or they brag about their. I meet writers. I meet people who aspire to be novelists, and they brag about the fact that they've never read a novel, and they don't want to read a novel because it would influence their writing. And of course, you know, that's absurd. But they don't know that it's absurd. The culture has reinforced some aspect of this belief system, and they believe it. And it, of course, makes me very sad. So I come back to that, what I think of as a cultural illness, quite often.
Mm-hmm. Now, teaching is a big part of your work. Is there specific things you take away from teaching? Do you do it because you enjoy it? Do you learn from it?
Yes.
That's an easy question.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I started teaching accidentally. I mean, I was trained as a teacher. I was trained as a writing instructor, but I did not set out to teach creative writing or fiction. I set out to be a writer, not to, to teach writing. But in order to teach myself to write, I started organizing writing information in particular ways that were useful to me. And I sort of accidentally discovered that they were useful to other writers. So I started sharing that, and then people wanted more of it. And it became, you know, a very, like, as you said, it's a big part of my creative life is this teaching. And yes, I learn a lot from it. There is a threshold at which you have to become a teacher in order to learn fast. You learn and you learn and you learn and you learn. And as you're learning, the frequency at which you are presented with new content decreases. And at that point, you sort of have to start turn around and start teaching in order to increase the frequency at which you encounter new content because of that perception issue I talked about before. But what happens is when you shift your perspective so that you have to get somebody else to move forward in their development, you have to see things in ways you had not considered, things you thought you knew. You know, I'm sure I understand how to use symbolism in this scene. Bullshit. You know, not until you actually help somebody else achieve a result do you have the perception that you thought you had. You know, what is the function of conflict and the opposition of will in a dramatic scene? Well, it's necessary in order to create tension. Well, yeah, okay, I learned that. It's necessary in order to help the reader see the characters and the contrast between them. Yeah, I learned that. And I was doing it, and I was happy, and then one day I had to show somebody how to do it, and I went, oh, shit, no. It is the absolute core of the pattern matching that a reader has for character behavior. It is the demonstration of the psychology of the character functioning so that the reader understands it. I can tell you how the reader thinks or how the character thinks, but it's like telling a little kid how they should behave. What they do is pay attention to how you behave. So, yeah, turning around and teaching that concept brought me new understanding of it. And every time I teach, I walk away with new stuff. I keep notebooks in my pocket because, you know, I'm talking to you right now, and I'm probably going to come out of this conversation with things that, you know, I haven't actually consciously thought about that I'll write down in my little notebook. So, yeah, teaching is a huge learning experience for me. It's also gratifying. You know, when you have one of your students actually do what you tell them to do and then sell their first story because of that, that's a big deal. There's a woman I worked with for several years who wrote her first novel and, you know, went out and sold it. And, I mean, yeah, I worked with her for 2 years, and she did things that I told her to do, and she worked hard, and she, you know, went out and sold that book. That's hugely gratifying. That's a big deal. It does two things. It helps them, and B, it confirms that what you're giving them is working. Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful feeling.
We're all waiting for that book on writing that you've got in there somewhere.
Oh God, you know, it's I don't know. It's written. I talked to an agent friend not long ago, and her response was that she couldn't sell it in the market the way it is. And I have personal issues with the how-to-write market. The How to Write market is about selling books. It's about selling articles. It's not necessarily about helping a writer who buys the book achieve success or a result. And I think a lot of writing books are geared toward delivering a message the reader wants to believe in, as opposed to delivering the skills the reader needs to become a professional writer. And that's kind of what she was saying to me. She was saying that, yeah, this is, and she's not the first one, that this is wonderful material and it's highly technical and useful, but selling it in the marketplace is a different thing. So we're exploring possibilities for that. We'll see what happens.
Do you get a lot of pushback on the technical kind of systematic approach? Or
is that
people not willing to, you know, break things down into actual blocks?
Well, there are two things that happen to me. I get a lot of pushback on it because it's an illusion. People hear what I show them, and they think that it's highly technical, and they think that it's a procedure that I'm presenting. And that's an illusion of linear presentation. You have to present it in an order, but the reality is that there is no correct order for the use of the material. So I modularize it. I say, here is a pattern that appears in successful writing. It appears over and over and over. No, it is not in all stories, but it is in many stories, and you can execute this. You can practice this chunk. Well, that's easy. They very rarely respond negatively to that. But if you show them 50 of those in a row, they start thinking they have to do them in that order. And it's weird. No matter how many times I tell them, no, there's not a correct order. Every story is different. But these things might be in your story when you're done, and you might use these things to make your story better. You know, there's several things that happen. You know, one is the psychological impact of it. Oh my God, this is too much. And I just wanted to sit down and have fun at my word processor and then be famous. Like, well, you don't need me for that. So go for it. The other one is that illusion of linearity. There is a profound undercurrent in the world that creativity cannot be understood. It's magic, it's talent, it's genetic. Of course, that's not true. It can be understood. There are, in fact, university programs for understanding creativity. They come out of the linguistic history, linguistic and cognitive science, of the study of the process of creativity. What makes successful creativity? You know, these things are studied. You can study them. There's a lot of belief in the ideal story, the classics. Now, this is a great story versus this is a not so great story, and that translates into this person's magic and this person's not. And the reality is that they're writing different stories and they're different people, and so they're going to get different results. So I get a lot of pushback for that. People accuse me of teaching formulaic writing, and I just laugh. I'm like, okay, so sentences have subjects, verbs, and objects. Are you limited in your production of a sentence by the fact that those things exist? No. And stories have components that are recognizable. Do all stories have the same, do you use those components the same way in every story? No. You know, can you break down the color wheel and make it into a spectrum and identify, you know, spectrums of wavelength? Say this wavelength from here to here, that's red. Well, yeah, you can do that. Does that mean that you can't create beautiful paintings? No. You know, the structure, the understanding of the patterns of success in a story doesn't eliminate the possibility of the creative combination of those patterns. It just allows you to do it more easily. It gives you a faster inroad. So I know people that are writing magically. You know, they're waiting for intuition, and they're only writing when they're inspired, and they've been working on the same book for 20 years, and I'm not exaggerating. The same book for 20 years, and they feel good about it, mm-hmm. You know. And I'm like, good. If that's the goal, then that's good. But if the goal is to produce at a professional level and sell your work, I can save you a lot of time.
Well, I can hear that you're still passionate about it, so that is a good thing. That is inspiring.
I am. There are very few things in my life that. I have been passionate about many things, but this thing has been forever, mm-hmm. And I am very grateful to the universe for that.
Darlene, do you want to jump on you again?
I want to, since we're talking about, I guess, the craft elements that you teach and that underlying structure, I want to ask about, kind of adjacent to that, I guess for you as a writer, as you were developing and then now, what kind of things did you do? Like, were you part of writers' groups? Did you take classes and instruction? And, you know, what did you find helped and hurt? And then how does that work for you now? Because obviously you teach, and as you say, you take a lot away from that in terms of learning new things. But do you also have some, who are your readers, but do you have some readers, or how does that work for you now to keep you going and inspired and whatnot? That was a lot.
Let's kind of break some of it out. I think the first piece of the question is about, paths forward for aspiring writers. And that means, workshops or writing groups. We'll use those terms interchangeably, workshop mm-hmm. and writing group or critique group. Conferences, teachers. Let's just look at those three. So, teachers. My background includes a wonderful father who said, if you want to learn to do something well, find an expert and make them teach you. I love the way, make them, he would kind of look at you. It's like, okay, I get it. Don't ask. Just, okay. So, from that perspective, at any given moment in my development, I was always looking for the best teachers I could find. And certainly, you don't always get to pick them. You don't have access to, you can't go and sit in Neil Gaiman's living room and make him teach you.
Alas.
You can, but they'll arrest you.
Yeah, exactly. So what you do instead is you go to conferences. And you meet other writers, and you meet teachers, and you listen to them. And you try to glean from them things that you can practice. And that's the hard one, because a lot of writers write intuitively. They develop their skills early. They don't know how they do what they do. But that does not mean that it can't be known. It's just that their developmental process didn't take them through the process of understanding how they do it. So like Stephen King tells people to just sit down and write. But Stephen King grew up in a family where storytelling was a big deal. He was writing a newspaper when he was 10 or 12. He was writing stories when he was in his early teens and in his high school years. And by the time he got to college, he was writing Carrie. So his storytelling process is intuitive. So an adult learning to write stories, say somebody in their 40s, 30s, 40s, 20s even, that's not a real viable path. Because the brain doesn't function the same way. It's the elasticity for language acquisition has changed. So you learn cognitively, you learn the same way you learn a second language. And to do that, you go find teachers that can show you how to execute technique. They can say, oh, you want to achieve this result for your reader, here's how you change the little black squiggles. And now you will get that result. And I looked for that. And I looked for that hard. And that came out of linguistic training in college. Understanding the difference between intuition and cognitive use of language allowed me to choose to do that. So now I advocate it for people. The conferences are networking opportunities. You meet other writers. You find out what's working for them. You find out what's not working for them. Valuable information saves a lot of time. You'll find teachers that right now in your process of development, you'll find teachers that speak to you. You think, that's what I need, and you'll work with them, and then later they won't mean anything to you. You'll go, oh, that wasn't very useful. But actually it was, because you had to go there to get where you are next. And then you'll find another teacher and you'll glom onto that. Certainly reading as many books on writing as you can get your bloody hands on. And again, for the same reason, different teachers will bring different things to the party. Sometimes they're expressing exactly the same concept, but one will express it in a way that's useful to the individual, and another will express it in a way that's useful to some other individual. But we all perceive the world differently, and how we get that information and how it plugs into our experience is going to be different from teacher to teacher. So you try different books. I sent you a list of books that I like, so you can look at that. And next week that list will be different because I'll be thinking about different things. So yes, writers' conferences I went to for many years. I found out they were very expensive. Anywhere, I was spending to go to a writer's conference, including the entry fees and then the hotel fees and the travel time and the travel expense, I was spending anywhere from $700 to $2,500 per conference. And so I started looking for ways to reduce that. And I had some skills fairly early on. I had skills with writing that I could teach. So I started out by just teaching word processing skills at conferences to reduce the cost, so I could get in for free. I could have a hotel room and stuff. I mean, really, that's what I did. And now I only go to conferences when I'm paid, and that's reduced the number of conferences. So right now I'm doing anywhere from 2 to 7 conferences a year. But those are only conferences that are willing to cover my expenses. And my rule is that I have to at least break even. I'm not going to spend my money to go to a conference to work for them. Mm-hmm. I can do that at home. You know, I can call people up on the phone and, you know, lecture. I just randomly dial people. No. So that's conferences for me. You will meet editors and agents. They certainly have to find people because their livelihood depends on it. But that, I don't think, is the primary reason for going. I think the primary reason for going is networking with writers and learning craft. You know, the word crafters in Eugene is, I think, one of the best things going on right now in Oregon, because they have eliminated that whole marketing thing, that marketing manic state that people get into, and they're focused entirely on the development of craft. Well, the development of craft brings you all of the other benefits of being a writer. You know, if your stories are rocking the world, you know, you'll get an agent. I've had 3 agents so far, you know, and probably will have, well, who knows, maybe not. The way the industry's going, I may not ever need an agent again. We'll see. But, you know, I didn't get that by being personable. I got that by having stories that they looked at and went, oh, yeah, I can make money. Mm-hmm. Well, that's from craft. That's not from running around marketing yourself at a conference. So from my perspective, yes, meet the agents, meet the editors, but sell your stuff, yeah, maybe. But primarily you're there for craft, you're there for development, you're there for networking. So then, you know, Willamette Writers is coming up. I'll be teaching a 4-class sequence at Willamette Writers in August. And
that's, for anybody who's not immediate to the podcast, that's Willamette Writers is in Portland, Oregon in August of 2016.
I think it's the second weekend in August this year. And I'm teaching a sequence, which means that each class builds on the next one. All the classes stand alone. Any one class is a set of techniques you can learn and use. But this year, if you take all 4 classes in sequence, then when you come to the last class, where I actually write a story in real time using the audience as the brain, all I'm bringing is technique, and I'm letting the audience brainstorm ideas, and then I'm applying the techniques to the ideas and creating story in real time up on stage. If you've been to all 4 classes or all 3 classes before that, then you understand exactly how I am selecting and why I am selecting the material I'm selecting from the brainstorm. And I don't get to do that very often. Usually a conference wants 1 or 2 classes, and they kind of pick from a menu of classes that I give them. And this time, Willamette Writers is letting me do this sequence. So that, you know, that's why you go to conferences, is to get that kind of thing. In terms of workshops, yes. The community, writing success comes in clusters. If you look at the history of literature, you discover that the things we think of as amazing writing, as great writing, the things we love, come from groups of creative people that challenge one another to move forward. Frankenstein, Mary Shelley. Mary Shelley didn't live in a vacuum when that was created. She was literally challenged by Percy and Byron. And I guarantee that the level of competitiveness in that little group went way up once she wrote Frankenstein.
I bet. So,
all right. You know, so this is just one example that everybody knows. But I attended my first critique group after I got out of graduate school. My first critique group was in Portland. And I learned a lot from it. Primarily, I learned things that you shouldn't do. I'm in touch with some of those people still. Some of them are still working on the novels that they were writing in 1990. Wow. However, others, there's a guy named Russ Gemerkin, who at the time was a window washer and studying Dead Sea Scrolls and writing books about the Dead Sea Scrolls. He's now considered one of the world's foremost authorities. And wow. He goes to conferences all over the world, and he's published a number of books. wonderful guy. This is a guy who was there and left and, you know, worked on his craft and worked in his skill and his discipline, and now he's achieved a level of success that a lot of people envy. So I left that and I went to other groups, a bunch of other groups, and I met a guy in 93 named James N. Fry, and I spent 2 weeks with him, and at the end of the 2 weeks I walked up to him and I asked him why they didn't teach me what he was teaching when I was in graduate school. And his response, I have never forgotten. He said, in graduate school, they teach you to write about what has been written. They don't teach you to take a blank page and create something new. And that's true and not true. There are certainly schools that do better than that by a long ways. But I started paying attention to the way he approached critique, and I started looking for critique groups that were focused on professional sale. And at one point, I was attending four groups at one time. One met twice a month. Two met once a week, and one was meeting once a month. And there was one group that I attended in Eugene when I lived in Portland. I drove 200 miles a night every Tuesday night to attend it.
Wow.
Because it was one of the most professional groups that I'd ever encountered. And I learned a lot about what worked and what didn't work. And so the thumbnail sketch of a critique group to achieve professional success is pretty simple. They don't get together to eat and drink wine. They get together to work. They get together very often. And I suggest once a week. Twice a week is starting to stretch it. Or twice a month is starting to stretch it. Once a month is not enough. I tell people that they should bring the manuscripts to the table and hand them out, so that the members have a week to read them. When they come back, they should be prepared to speak for 2 minutes and no more than that, to bring out the number one things in the manuscript that should be improved, and to identify the things that should be kept. I tell them that they should provide a written critique, both, so they're going to speak, and they're also going to have it written up. And that means they had to think about it enough to create a coherent response. And finally, and I think most importantly, I tell people that they need to engage in principled criticism. You know, anybody can say it's slow. Oh, well, I was on page 12 and the manuscript's kind of slow there, you should punch it up. You'll hear that. Or you'll hear people say it's kind of passive through here, because they don't actually know what passive voice is and they just didn't like what they were reading. That's pretty much useless information. But if somebody says on page 12, your character is not at maximum capacity, on page 6 you establish that the character has these attributes, and on page 12 if they use those attributes they would take different action. So they've started to ignore the attributes you've defined for them on page 12. And as a consequence, the conflict is no longer functioning well for the story, and you're losing the dramatic tension that's necessary in order to drive the story into the next scene, and the reader's losing sympathy for the character. That's useful. And then if you can tell them how to fix it, and what the possible result of the scene would be because you changed that character to maximum capacity, now you have something useful. So principled criticism is about identifying the aspect of the story that function, identifying the aspects of the story that don't function, and replacing the things that don't function with new tools that do function. And that means you have to begin by understanding your concept of what the writer's trying to achieve. So I read the story, and then I step back and I say, what is this story trying to achieve thematically? What is this story trying to achieve emotionally for the reader? And I have to begin with that. I have to be able to state that, because I can't provide any advice that's useful unless I have made that statement and can connect my advice to those results. Now, I might be wrong. Your story, you might have completely different intentions for your story, but only you can decide that. I, as the reader, have to make that choice in order to provide criticism. That's principled criticism. That's working from a knowledge base. And that means that you have to constantly read, study, and practice. Okay, so, you know, that's good critique. Now you go to a critique group. Somebody says, oh, I want to join a writer's group. And they go and they join the writer's group. And they go to their first night at the writer's group. And they pass out the wine. And then somebody sits up and they go around Robin and they read their stories out loud. And then the person next to them says, well, I really liked it. I thought the characters were compelling and the action was very exciting. And I think you could sell that. And the next person says, I don't like the fact that you referred to Christians in the negative, and I think that you need to go back and rewrite it so that this character is more of a Christian. And the next person says, well, I think it needs more sex. You know, it's like, what the hell is that? That's useless. First of all, they read the story out loud, and you will never, ever get to sit down with an editor and read your story out loud. ever. No editor that I know will take the time to read your story out loud. They can't afford it. So the story is not an oral form. Poetry is an oral form. And yes, you can read your story out loud as part of the editing process, but if you're looking for honest feedback on your story, you shouldn't even be in the room with them when they're reading it. They should be reading it silently and privately and then doing their analysis. So I very much dislike oral groups, and I really don't like oral groups that allow immediate response because people don't have time to think through the nature of the story in order to create results for the writer that are useful. So yeah, don't get me started on that.
Too late.
Yes, it's too late. Sorry about that. Anyway, no. So yes, I think what writers groups are very good. Community is important. However, be careful. Find groups that are clearly focused on professional publication and that are constantly reading, studying, practicing technique and not just responding to their experience of the story. Find groups that are helping you achieve your intended result instead of groups that are trying to impose their desire on your story. Two different things.
Have you reached a point where you needed to leave a group?
Yes.
Are there any advice on how to do that?
Walk away.
I know. The problem with groups is the relationships you develop. I think that becomes difficult.
You don't have to give up the relationships, but you do have to recognize that writers grow, and if you are a writer, you will grow, you will change. And I don't mean grow as in become more mature or better. I mean change. No two writers are learning the same things. We all come with a set of inherent equipment, and it's not the same for any two people. So the judgments about better, best, worse, that's all bullshit. Mm-hmm. But a particular group will have a particular function for you for a while, and then it will cease to function on that level because you change. There's no right or wrong to it. There's just the fact that you've changed. So in the best case, you become so busy because you're selling your stories that you can't do it anymore. It takes a lot of time, but it's very valuable time to spend. In the worst case, I had a woman come up to me in a critique group once and chew me out for always being so hard on her stories. Why are you always so hard on my stories? I don't bring my stories here so that you can chew them, tear them apart. That's what she said, so that you can tear them apart. And I said, well, why do you bring them? And she says, because I just want to enjoy them. And my response to that was, well, you don't need me for that. You don't need me to read your story so that you can enjoy it. Now, if you need me to come and enjoy your story, then we're here for the wrong reasons. Well, I left that group because that group met at her house. Mm-hmm. So it was never going to get better. Mm-hmm. And and that's a legitimate reason. You know, if she wants to enjoy her story, that's fine. I was not helpful to her. I wasn't helpful to anybody in that group. I was a pain in the ass. So I needed to find a group where I wasn't a pain in the ass. So I went and found a group that terrified me. Mm-hmm. That was useful. Mm-hmm. You know, I walked into that room the first night, and people were, you know, there's like 25 people in this room, and they're all talking and chatting, and some of them are yelling, and one guy's sitting there drinking. You know, I mean, that was crazy. And I walked in, and I thought, wow, somebody told me this was a really good group. This is insane. And then this guy rang a bell, and everybody shut up and sat down, and they started working. And they went through 6 manuscripts in an hour and a half, and it was like watching machine guns go off. I mean, they'd say, you know, who's up next? And somebody'd say, I am. And they'd say, which direction? Left. Okay. And the manuscripts had all been read ahead of time. The critiques were prepared, and they went around that table, 25 people, and they did it 6 times in an hour and a half. And I sat there, and I'm not joking, I sat there shaking, just terrified. I was in that group for 7 years. So yeah, amazing different groups. Yeah. Pardon?
So that's an amazing group, and I bet you learn a lot that way because you really get to dig in and figure out from critiquing people's manuscripts more about your own writing as well.
Well, that's another thing. People go to critique groups because they want to get their manuscript critiqued. And I think that's just stupid. You don't go to a critique group to get your own manuscript critiqued. You go to a critique group to learn to critique manuscripts.
Right.
So, you know, if you've got 6 manuscripts on the table and one of them's yours, and there's 25 people, you're going to get 25 responses, and there's going to be a lot of overlap. But if you spend, two or three hours with each manuscript of the other five. It's that time that you're spending. You're spending, 20 hours a week analyzing manuscripts to see what works and breaking it down into functional executable skills. That's where the value is. You get a 5-to-1 ratio of learning if you're there to analyze manuscripts. If you're just there to get a critique, then you're not learning very fast. Also, if you're there to analyze, then it doesn't matter how bad the critiques are, because critiques are all over the place. Some people are just learning, and they're saying, oh, it's kind of slow through here. Or, I don't find this character sympathetic. Well, you're not supposed to. You're supposed to hate his guts. So that's not useful. But they're just learning. But if you spent your time analyzing manuscripts, then you are learning, because you're at the edge of your learning curve when you're doing that all the time, instead of waiting for somebody else to pick up their pace and get to the point where they're being useful to you. You're being useful to yourself. So I tell people, join a critique group. Stop worrying about what they say about your manuscript. When they say something useful, you'll know. Mm-hmm. But spend a lot of time analyzing those other manuscripts, because that's where you learn.
We are a little bit over time, but this has been such an awesome conversation. And I did want to ask one more question that we were going to ask really early on, but I feel like it's also important before we stop. And that is, so we came in and we thought we were going to be talking about Bull's Labyrinth, which we did, and it's amazing. But then this week you also dropped Professor Witchy's Miracle Mood Cure, which is a collection of short stories.
Yeah.
Which is really exciting. Do you want to talk just a teeny bit about those? And also, I guess we're both curious about, you write all of these short stories, over 100 published. You have novels out. Like, how do you do this all? And how do you see yourself? Are you a novel writer or a short story writer or primarily, or do you discern? So
I'm a writer. I don't discern. Some stories need to be a novel. Some stories need to be a novella. Some stories need to be a short story. I don't look at myself as a novelist. I don't look at myself as a short story writer. I don't look at myself as a technical writer. I don't look at myself as a consultant. I use all of those terms in different contexts, but I think of myself as a writer. And when I'm working with story, I very much only think of myself as a writer telling a story. And that story is going to determine its own length. The short stories in the Miracle Mood Cure, I did not pick them. The editor picked them. I gave them 50 stories. And the editor went through the 50 stories and picked the ones that she wanted to be in the collection. And I have to say that some of them I am really on board with, and some of them I thought, now why the hell did she pick that? But only 7 of them are new. Most of them are published somewhere. And there are 25 in the collection, and 7 of them are previously unpublished. And a couple of those I'm really happy to see coming out, because it's unlikely they were ever going to find a place to go into print, but I like the stories. And they're kind of like Bull's Labyrinth. It's like, we don't know what this is, so we're not going to publish it. So it's kind of nice to see that happening. I'm happy to see it coming out. I'm happy that it's got the diversity in it that it has. I'm surprised that she didn't pick some more of the literary stories. She picked primarily science fiction and fantasy, which is fine. And I think maybe, it's correct to have it sort of grouped that way. So there'll probably be another collection of literary stories that, aren't science fiction and fantasy. That's fine, too. So yeah, it's exciting that they're both coming out at the same time. Is really just a function of the internal workings of the publishing company and the hope that we can have them in paper before Willamette Writers as a launch point. But the world works the way the world works, and we'll see what happens.
It's very exciting to have so many good things out in the world. So
it is.
All right.
Very happy.
Well, we would like to end our interview with a little spot of inspiration for those writers who are striving to master their craft. Do you have a little last piece of wisdom to leave our listeners with?
Oh, yeah. Short? So, I have mantras. One of them, start early, work often. One of them is make mistakes faster. And, of course, put it in the mail. We didn't talk about that. but nobody remembers bad stories. So practice putting the stories out there. You know, get rejection letters, savor them, love them, embrace them. If you're trying to be a professional writer and you're not just going out and saying, oh, well, I wrote this story and I'm going to put it on the internet, you know, that's like the lady that sits in her living room and says she likes her stories. You know, you don't need me for that. You don't need to learn anything to do that. You can do it. But if you really, really want people to read your story, you want to win awards, you want to get money, you want, you know, editors and agents to pay attention to what you're doing, then you have to learn the craft, and it boils down to sitting in the chair and practicing consciously. So start early, work often, make mistakes faster, and put it in the mail. No matter how bad you think it is, put it in the mail. Editors and agents sit around waiting for the opportunity to find a new writer. They really, really love that. And they don't care how many bad stories you sent them, because they see it developing. In fact, they develop name recognition. As you get better, they start rooting for you. And they'll tell you that. You talk to them at conferences, they'll tell you that. They'll say, yeah, you know, they'll name people. They'll say, I know so-and-so, and so-and-so's been sending to me for 5 years, and she's getting there. She's almost there. You know, I expect to buy a story from her in the next 2 or 3 times. And it's because she kept sending in bad stories that they know her name. So, you know, put them out there.
Sounds great. All right. How can our listeners and adoring fans find you? Your readers, I guess.
The website is ericwitchie.com. I don't know that that's finding me, but you can find lists of stories and stuff. And then you can get a hold of me at eric@ericwitchie.com, of course. On Twitter, I'm at uppercase E, uppercase W, I-T-C-H-E-Y, E-Witchie. See, there's a blog, Shadow Spinners. I share a blog with, 7 or 8 other writers. And I don't know what the frequency is now, but every week we publish a blog entry from one of the writers, and every so many weeks I come up again and have one there. You can find articles about, you know, I've written essays about writing. They're mostly about the writing life for me, and, you know, some of them are inspirational and some of them are technique-oriented. Those are the best ways to get a hold of me or to connect with me. You can Google my name. You can find out what I'm doing by Googling my name, Eric Witchie. You can go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble and search on my name, and you'll find stories. There's also stories out there that I've sold that are now available for free. You know, like one of my favorite stories is a story called Brianna's Constant, which is a very fun science fiction story. And it's still out online. You know, I sold it to, I think it was Clark's World or Bane's Universe. I don't know. Anyway, I sold it and you can find it online. There's another one called Running Water for L.A. That you can find online. And they're just, you know, I sold the stories and they're out there and you can find them and read them. So just Google my name. Just Google Eric Witchie and you'll find stuff.
What is your preferred place for folks to buy Bull's Labyrinth? Or the place where you get more money?
Oh, well, my preferred place is to have them order it from a bookstore because I get the most money from that. If they, you know, if they want to buy it for, like right now, I mean today and tomorrow, it's going to be available for 99 cents. But by the end of the week, it's going to be $7.95 to buy the electronic version. And when they buy the electronic version, it just doesn't matter where they buy it, Barnes and Noble, whatever their reading device requires, it's the same to me. I get the same percentage. The money goes to the publishing company. The publishing company shaves their piece, and then they give me the rest. So that doesn't matter. But, you know, it's up to them. What do they like to read? How do they like to read? You know, if you want paper, go to your bookstore. If they don't have it, order it. And if you want ebook, go to Amazon or go to Barnes & Noble or go to iBooks. Or there are also aggregate sites out there, places where basically if you buy it from them, then you're really buying it from Amazon or you're buying it from Barnes & Noble, but they get a shave. They get a percentage because you bought it through that website. Again, just, you know, Google Eric Witchie and you can find those places.
Cool. All right.
All right. Well,
thank you
very much for talking with us today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.